Hi everyone, welcome to my channel Journey and Beyond Untold Stories. Today we have someone very, very special with us. His name is Kem. Kem is an innovator who is making incredible strides in the mental health space. Kem is the founder of Resonate, a company developing cutting-edge medical devices for depression treatment. He brings a wealth of experience from his PhD and postdoc at the University of Oxford, where he studied the brain oscillatory patterns, leadership roles in global humanitarian operations. Please join me as we explore his fascinating journey, the challenges of addressing mental health, and the future of personalized treatment in this critical field. Hi, Kem. Welcome to my channel, Journey and Beyond Untold Stories. How are you and how's it going? How's life?
Yeah, hi Shefali. Thanks for having me on. I'm good. Life's good. Life's good. It's a beautiful sunny day here in Sydney. We've got a lot to talk about what my team at Resonate's been up to.
I know, right? I have a lot to talk about. But before we talk about Resonate, I want to start with your journey from when you were at UN and then you were at Oxford. How did you get your first opportunity at the UN? It's a big deal, right?
Yeah, totally.
What did it teach you about the leadership and global challenges?
Yeah, so it's funny, my career has kind of taken a few unexpected turns. I've followed a few opportunities that I never would have seen coming, and my move to the UN was one of those. So I was planning to go and do a PhD after I finished my kind of undergrad. Basically, it came about because there was a gap between the time that uni's finished in Australia and uni's started up overseas. And I had 6 months to kill, and I thought, oh, what can I do? And somehow landed upon a volunteer gig with the World Food Programme. So I started out as a volunteer working in their office in Bangkok doing software development. So I was hired as a software developer to essentially, there was a project where they were simulating emergencies. So the World Food Programme is the UN's sort of lead agency for emergency logistics for humanitarian agencies. And so it's really crucial for them to understand these emergencies, how they're going to respond. And part of that is computer simulations. But essentially, that was like my pathway into the emergency team. And after 6 months, rapidly moved out of software development just into, I guess the emergency team is the kind of place where they just grab people when people are needed. I sort of moved from what was a very technical position into emergency management roles and emergency operations. So that 6 month gap turned into 5 years all of a sudden. And then eventually I said, hang on, I actually do really want to go do a PhD. So I did go and pursue that.
Nice. Yeah. And then you ended up landing at Oxford. Wow. Such an overachiever. So talk about what inspired your shift from World Food Programme at the UN to neuroscience and brain mapping at Oxford. Because it's two different worlds, right?
Totally. Yeah. And like I say, with my career, there isn't a single cohesive thread. I've just been lucky with having these incredible opportunities. And as an undergrad, I was really passionate about neuroscience and just fascinated by trying to understand the brain and how it worked, what's going on up there effectively. And so that was always a real sort of interest point of mine. Now I was drawn, again, it's just the opportunity. It's being able to go to Oxford and study with really the world's leading thinkers, leading scientists on understanding how our brains are actually computing information, how we're managing to do all of the things that we do. It was something that I definitely couldn't pass up. And yeah, it was quite the shift. I guess the UN work is very challenging, but in very different ways. It isn't so, you know, there's an enormous amount of work to do. It's not particularly intellectual work. And so I guess I was drawn back into something there where I had to really stop and think about a problem in depth and analyze things with, you know, the length of time that you just don't have the luxury of in emergency operations. So it really was kind of polar opposites in that sense.
That's amazing and that's so inspiring, Kem. Want to understand, you have lived in so many countries. Say you have lived in US and then you moved to UK. You have lived in Bangkok as well before that. and then you moved to Australia. What major challenges did you face working in diverse environments, and how did you adapt to the change?
So being on the emergency team, there were even a lot of places where I was stationed, but so I lived in Italy for 3 years, but I was traveling 75% of the time. And so it didn't actually feel like I was living in Italy because it was sort of, you know, 1 week a month that I'd be back there trying to sort my life out and then off to another country. So I'd say like that was definitely quite challenging. It was also super exciting, and I was, you know, in my early 20s at the time. I think I'd find that even more challenging these days to try to keep up with it. I think going from
places...
What's that? I'm getting old, yeah.
We're getting old.
But in terms of the challenges, I think probably the hardest thing, communication between people of different cultures. There's so much that, you know, trying to manage a large scale operation, it all comes down to people, right? And a huge, probably the biggest element of management in my mind is how you really understand the people that you're working with, what drives them, what motivates them. And that's incredibly challenging when you don't really understand the culture. You don't know the hidden cues. There's a lot that's left unsaid. And so that's probably the hardest thing, that a lot of the time you are flying blind in so many respects and having to still make decisions without really having the confidence behind you that you've fully grasped what is going on underneath the surface. So that's incredibly challenging.
Yeah. So how many languages do you speak? You speak English only.
Well, I could say maybe one and two halves. I was at one stage I was fluent in Spanish, yeah, and then I moved to Italy and I learned Italian just by mostly speaking Spanish and substituting out word for word over time, which is actually now if I try to speak Spanish, it's just this horrible mix of Italian and Spanish words.
Right. So, Kim, you are such an overachiever, right? I mean, I can't stop myself saying that.
You're someone
who has worked at the UN, Oxford, all the big tags. What made you start your own company? Because it's a hard journey. And how did your experience at the UN and Oxford shaped, you know, your journey with your new venture?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why did I start Resonate? Ultimately, I'm somebody that's always been, I guess, driven by impact and wanting to see what I'm doing, how that actually translates to people in the real world. Definitely, you know, my first real job was at the UN, which is somewhere where your sort of benchmark for impact is really quite high. The work that you do, you know, the World Food Programme feeds 100 million people each year. So you know when you can see the impact that your work is having. It's very, very clear and obvious. With going into academia, I was still motivated by impact. I guess, so I was in academia for 8 years, and I guess there was a sense at the end, it took me quite some time to get up to speed with neuroscience and where, you know, the current standard of science was. And then there was this sense that, wow, we're coming up with, there's a lot that we've actually learned about the brain, but it isn't being used for anything. It's sort of this very niche group of experts around the world who all mutually understand what each other are talking about, but that hasn't been translated out to anything practical and useful. There are several ways in which neuroscience has been used, but it's still quite shocking when you look at modern psychiatry and just how little moved between neuroscience and clinical practice, how slow that translation is. So ultimately that was what motivated me to set up Resonate, was because I thought there's got to be an opportunity here for this to actually, the things that we know about how brain health links to mental health, to actually deploy that into practice in the midst of a mental health crisis. I started my business at the end of COVID as well, which was when, you know, the mental health system has been struggling for a while. It was really, really struggling then.
So, okay. So you were talking about Resonate and mental health. What gaps in the mental health treatment is Resonate addressing?
Yeah, so Resonate's vision is to accelerate recovery from depression. That's why we exist, because the real problem that we see, you're not going to be able to solve the depression crisis, but the problem is that the system's just not treating people fast enough. So you see people on waiting lists. It's currently about a six-month wait to see a psychiatrist in Australia, or about a three-month wait to see a psychologist. And then people get onto treatments that, if it's antidepressant medication, they might be weaned on over a period of 6 weeks to 3 months. You know, it's months before they might see any improvement. And then they're weaned off over months later if that hasn't happened and it's time to try something else. So that's really where we see the opportunity, is in shortening that pathway so that people can get onto something quickly that starts working for them.
Yep, it's amazing. How did it, like, you don't have a customer yet, right? You're rolling the clinical trial and you're in the process of TGA approval. Is that correct?
That's right.
So how your business model will work? Will you tie up with clinicians, pathologists, or,
Exactly. Our plan is to go through clinics. So we will be providing a platform that clinics can sign onto that they can then sign their clients onto. So how that would work in practice, when I was just talking about trying to accelerate that pathway, when people call up and they're placed on a wait list for 3 months, that's when they can be offered, instead of just waiting for 3 months to see what happens, they can be offered to go straight onto this platform and start using the tech to get them started on that pathway whilst they're waiting to see a psychologist, and then they continue that through that course there.
Yeah, right. Okay. Amazing. So with AI evolving rapidly, what are your thoughts on its role in mental health space?
Oh, it's so interesting.
I know, right?
One of those things, who knows really, but one of the things that I find fascinating, like, I've already been proven wrong on, I thought initially everybody was talking about AI chatbots, and I kind of said, nah, people go to see a therapist for a human connection. And that's still true. It doesn't mean that people don't want to talk to chatbots. They just talk to them it's like a completely different form of therapy, where people, instead of slowly building trust and then exposing their issues over the course of weeks or even months, with chatbots, they tend to just go straight in and they just tell all their deepest, darkest secrets straight up. So it's interesting that the human interaction with AI is in fact quite different to that human-human interaction. So it's really hard to know how that, there's going to be a space for that. It's not going to replace human therapists, but it's going to fit in as some slightly different form of therapy. And, you know, that's just one example. I think there's many others. We're using AI to support analysis of brainwave information so that you can actually have interventions that are instantly triggered when particular brain networks are activated to help kind of shape those thinking habits back in a way that supports recovery. But I think it is just one of those spaces that we're going to see some pretty big changes in the next few years. And it's hard to know exactly what they are. It's an exciting time,
No, definitely. So, Kim, with so many people struggling with mental health today, right? It can be our office colleague, it can be, you know, a cleaner in our office, or it can be someone outside, or one of our friends, or maybe our boss, or maybe, you know, director of an organization. What advice do you have for those looking to help themselves?
Yeah, so for those who are looking to help themselves, you're right. It's unfortunate there are so many people in this situation. I think the one thing that I would say is that mental health is so idiosyncratic, so individualized. It's still, there's no universal answer, and a lot of people will pretend I did this and it worked for me, and that becomes their advice for everybody. I think for all these people, it's about finding what works for you and what you think is going to be the right approach for you. Most of the time will be right. So I think for those people, there's all these kind of solutions, apps, things that you can use. It's really about thinking through yourself, what do I really need? And that's often done best with a local GP or some kind of specialist. Be able to sit and talk with somebody who you trust about the issues that you're going through and try to come up with that plan of what do you think is going to be right for you. It's a tough one, but yeah, there's no one size fits all, and there's all kinds of things that can work for people that are completely out of the box that you might not have thought of. So yeah.
Can you describe how does mental health problem looks like depression or having this kind of illness which people can't see physically? It's right. Just so important, and it's so good that now people are coming out and they see mental health as just any other problem. Mm-hmm. There's no stigma around it. I mean, there is still stigma, but it's reducing now.
Exactly.
I'm just wondering, can you describe how does mental health problems like depression looks like?
So funnily enough, they can present very differently in different people. And there are sort of clusters, if you will, where there are people who have more cognitive symptoms, where if you ask them to describe their depression, it's in terms of their thought patterns being overwhelmingly negative and being, you know, taking a very pessimistic view on everything. But that isn't the case for everybody. There's other clusters for whom it's more physiological, for whom it's a complete lack of energy, trouble sleeping, either falling asleep or sleeping too long, sleeping at the wrong times, and just never having energy and engagement, never feeling excited by things. So there's sort of another cluster there of people for whom they may not be subjectively feeling negative, they're just feeling numb and not feeling anything. So there really are these different subtypes, and it can look quite different for different people. I guess there I've also just focused on depression. There's a whole range of mental health issues beyond depression, obviously, as well. And I think that what I just described is kind of a case for all of them. There's all these little subtypes and nuances within that.
Yeah. And these are the people who smiles and laughs with us every day.
Yeah.
Around us.
Exactly.
That's how depression looks like, right?
Yeah. So often there is just that, there's the facade and then what's actually going on behind it.
Behind the scenes, yeah. You are a founder and CEO of Resonate. How many hours do you have to work in a day? Can you give some insight in your schedule?
Yeah, it's definitely a few. Look, I still make sure that, so I've been doing this for 3 years and the hours sort of crept up steadily over time. These days I'm making sure that I actually, have a day off on the weekends and so on. But yeah, it's definitely fairly full on. Admittedly, a lot of what I do though, there's a lot of attending events of pitching and so on, which, I don't know, it doesn't always feel like work. There's long days, but it doesn't feel as long if you really enjoy it. Yeah, exactly.
That's nice. Yeah. Because you're so passionate about what you're doing. And definitely you're doing such an amazing thing. So more power to you.
Thank you. You were a founder as well, right? You know, the story. When you're actually loving it, it doesn't feel as...
As a founder, how do you balance the demand of running a startup with the importance of mental health for yourself and for your team?
Yeah, right. That's a really good question, because it has been one that's at times tricky to manage. I've settled into a routine recently. Like I said, my kind of work demands scaled with the business and reached a point where it was a little bit problematic. And so since then, I mentioned I'm kind of making sure to have a day off on the weekends. And I also, for me, fitness is a huge part of it. So when work is eating into my fitness schedule is when things are not so sustainable. Mm. So these days, like I'm a member of a rowing team, and so I go out and I'm on the water at 5 a.m. in the morning many, many days of the week. And that's good because you can kind of partition that time. Nobody's calling you for anything. I don't know, for me, that really, really helps, having that kind of exercise workout each day. That's probably the biggest thing, and trying to make sure that there's a kind of rounded lifestyle, so other elements of my life beyond work that are rich and rewarding. So
nice. That's good. As a founder, you go through a lot in the journey, right? I mean, you do enjoy, you're passionate about bringing your idea to the real world, But in the same time, founders go through a lot, both mentally, physically, financially. Who has been the biggest source of strength for you?
Right. So I would say my family throughout this have been constantly by my side. And, you know, like you say, it's a bit of a roller coaster ride. There's ups and there's downs. And probably 90% of the startup world are with you for the ups, and a much lower percent are with you for the downs. But, you know, my family has been steadfast throughout. And just when you have people that have that absolute kind of confidence in you, that pulls you through those tough patches. Yeah.
What personal traits have helped you excel across different fields? You've been at the UN, you've been at Oxford. What personal trait has been game changer for you?
So that's a good question. It's kind of hard for me to answer looking inwards myself, but I think it's possibly an enthusiasm and, you know, one of the things that, like even with Resonate, we're a company that set out to accelerate recovery from depression. But one of our first company values is that work should be fun. And so I think, you know, that's a particular attitude. Obviously, work isn't always going to be fun, but I always try to make it fun. And I think, yeah, you know, with the World Food Program, I was, you know, I managed to have fun in a bunker in Afghanistan. Kind of one of those lessons was that you can make work fun regardless wherever you are. It's an attitude and it's the people that you're with. And bringing that kind of team spirit together can get you through some pretty tough times otherwise.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. How do you manage the pressure of achieving things in life? And what are your strategies for handling burnout or stress?
Yeah, so I've always been somebody that's pretty determined. So for me, it's about goals and having really quite simple goals that this is, you know, one or two things that this is what I'm doing. Because for me, I think my ability to achieve things is partly just through sheer bloody minded obsession with one thing that is what I'm going to do. And so that's probably one of the big parts of it. With burnout and stress, I think what I was saying before about mental health, for me, exercise is just a huge part of it. And it's trying to have those single goals whilst also having a rounded life outside of that as much as possible.
Yeah, and sometimes you have a different perspective and you take a break, just go out, get some fresh air, work out, and you come back and you're like, oh, yeah, I have a solution.
I mean, that's one thing that I've found as well, right?
Not
being chained to a desk with my boss looking. There's days when you're just like, oh, this isn't working.
Yeah, no,
so we'll go for a run and come back.
Oh, it's working now.
Exactly. Or you can sit there and like bash your head against a computer screen for 8 hours
and not really get
anywhere. So, yeah.
So what advice do you have for breaking into a new industry? Say someone is new in a country, someone is trying to get into new industry, especially without having a direct experience, like you have switched career quite a few times yourself. What advice do you have for them?
Meet people and ask questions, probably. So find the people who are in that industry and buy them. Just set yourself a budget for buying people coffee. It's amazing how far you can get and how quickly you can get up to speed from sitting people down and just asking them about their career and their industry. And the other part of that is that most people are pretty happy to talk about themselves and their career and their life and share that sort of information, especially in the context of, hey, I'm new here, I'm trying to break into this. I think most people you'll find are very supportive and helpful along that path. So use that help when you can get it.
Yep, amazing. So you were an immigrant in the US, UK. What advice would you give to immigrant professionals navigating new industries and work culture?
That's an interesting question. I'm not really sure, to be honest. I think it's possibly the same advice as what I had for anybody trying to break into a new space. There's definitely, you know, being in the UK as an Australian, there are so many Australians there that I'm not sure it's completely comparable to most immigrants' experience in Australia. But you know, there are still strong perceptions that people have, preconceptions about Australians that put up barriers, right? And I think that's probably the hardest thing for migrants in Australia. How do you overcome those barriers? Yeah, I wish I had the answers. I think the only thing I would say is to what I was saying before, it comes back to that, just try to grow your network, speak to as many people as possible, and get their advice. Use those kind of support levers where you can.
Yeah, right. Can many entrepreneurs struggle with imposter syndrome? Have you ever experienced it? And if so, how did you overcome it?
You know, it's funny. Whilst I understand imposter syndrome, I don't think it's quite something that I have experienced, because I've always had the sense that I haven't done enough here. I need to have done more. I would never say I felt like an imposter, because I was always, fairly transparent about this is the level that I'm at. I wish it was up here, but it's here. So, you know, in academia, there's a million papers and you always wish that you'd read more, and you get asked questions that you don't know the answers to, that you feel like half the room does. I can understand where some people get that imposter syndrome. In my case, it was the sense that, oh God, I haven't done enough here. But I think you can also use that to your advantage. That's something that can drive you to do more, to excel further. Yeah. Constantly strive to have done a bit more than that.
Yeah, correct. If you were to start the same company again, what would you do differently?
That's a really tough question. It's funny because Resonate's been going for 2.5 years, and a lot has changed in terms of what we're doing over that time, but none of the big things have. So the goal, the product definition has shifted a bit, but not that much. When I look back, like, it still, as a founder, it's so frustrating, all the dead time, so the dead ends that we ran down. You know, I'd like to go back and change that, but I think you also, that's the reality of a startup business, is that you need to run down these laneways that nobody else has run down in order to know that it's a dead end, right? You need to chase so many opportunities. And so if I could change anything, I'd like to have just made every opportunity go immediately the way that we now know it should have. But I don't think that's realistic. So.
Nice. You've worked in so many different countries, people with different cultures. How has your experience influenced the way you think about diversity and inclusion?
Yeah, so look, it's a really, really important thing. I think, so one of the things, I have worked in quite male-dominated workplaces. And one of the things that is really striking is that there's sort of a critical mass where once something becomes overwhelmingly male-dominated, like, it's unappealing to anybody to be sort of the first woman coming into that. It's not a conducive environment. And it's sort of like, once you have that problem ingrained in a company, it is so hard to reverse it, because you also have all these network effects that you've got this, in this case, it's a blokey culture, but it applies to any kind of diversity metric, where there's all these other networks that you're just not reaching. And so it becomes, it's sort of a, what do you call it? The kind of feedback loop, that if you don't get that right early on, it becomes harder and harder to correct later. So it is something that I'm conscious of growing Resonate with our team, that it needs to be something that's kind of instilled in us from the get-go, that we're hiring across a range of cultures and backgrounds quite deliberately in order to ensure that we have that diversity.
That's great. That's good to keep in mind, just to be inclusive of people from the different backgrounds.
Mm.
That's amazing. So is your company hiring? Do you have a team?
So, yeah, we have a small team. We're still a pretty lean operation. So there's 3 people on the core team right now. We're looking to hire 2 more later this year right now. But essentially, we've got a team of neuroscience experts. And now that we're getting closer and closer to market, we're looking to hire out to build out the commercial side of the business, really mapping out that kind of the pathway into the market as these products approach market listing.
Right, gotcha. If you have hired and if you're thinking to hire, when you're hiring for your company, what qualities do you look in a candidate?
I guess the answer is it depends. One of the things that, like, the best candidates that I've had have been those that have sought me out. And it's funny, like, it's not, that's in many ways, it's one of the strongest indications of somebody that is proactive. And, you know, if they're willing to hunt down an employer, the, you know, in interviews, when you're asking the question of why do you want to work here, and people have something that's prepared and, you know, cool. Might be that they just need a job. Like, those that are really passionate are the ones that are hunting down the company. So that's been, like, something that I've found. Obviously, that isn't, when you need a particular position, that isn't necessarily that much help. So I think people's ability to, there's sort of, you have the technical skills, right? And that needs to be rock solid. There's then how you can communicate that and how you can interact with the rest of the team. And that's something that I think comes through over time. You know, when I've been hiring, I've mostly hired people as contractors and got them working for a period of time long before hiring them as an employee. They say, you know, hire slowly and fire fast. But in this case, hire slowly, make sure that people really fit the team and fit the team dynamic and slot in well before really committing to them, because it's such a crucial thing for an early stage company, the first few hires.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely critical to get right.
Yeah. That's amazing. Thank you so much for taking our time to jump on a call with us. And it was lovely having you on our platform.
Yeah, no. Thanks so much for having me, Shefali. It's been great chatting.